Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Well, folks, despite my choleric nature that you just heard me share with Jim Duff, this has been quite a start to the week. Two brewing storms. One in the Middle East that continues. One approaching New Orleans on the anniversary of last year's that we'll look at later in the hour. We're going to start with some just fascinating news out of the Middle East. Two announcements, two declarations. I don't know if one led to the other. Our next guest is going to lead us through some speculation on it. But the first concerns Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader who took the prisoners, launched the rockets, started the Mideast war, now says, oops, gee, if I knew Israel would have reacted like that, I wouldn't have done it. He probably thought that, you know, it's perfectly normal. It's a normal tool of diplomacy. You go in, you breach a sovereign nation's borders, kill 8 of their soldiers, take 2 hostage, throw over a couple of 100 rockets, and they'll just sit down and negotiate for their own prisoners. It was a remarkable statement that he made, that he wouldn't have done it had he known Israel's reaction. All this blood, all this destruction. And on the other side, Israel made a remarkable statement, not about the war, but perhaps what is a coming war, by naming the general in charge of what they call the Iran Front. Air Force Chief Ephraim Shkedny has been named to deal with the planning and preparations for any potential conflict that may arise with Iran. It struck me as very coincidental, and I'm not a big believer in coincidences, that these two remarkable statements would come out on one day. That the Israeli their announcement, remarkable, because what do you tell an enemy what you're doing and who you're doing it with, unless you're trying to send a message that you recognize their weakness? Israeli military analyst Yuri Dromi said, I think we have 1 year open to launch military action against Iran's nuclear program, and Israel will decide. That combined with Nasrallah's statement that basically snatches defeat from the jaws of the perceived victory, and I say perceived because certainly there can be no victory when by Nasrallah's own statements in that speech, they lost 50% of their rockets, most of their infrastructure, all of their 47 long-range launch sites. And the last 3 days of the war, when the Israeli Prime Minister finally allowed the Israeli army to go boots on the ground, they sliced through Hezbollah territory like a knife through butter, and in 36 hours were the Litani River. But you're not going to hear much of that. There's going to be recriminations. But these two point and counterpoint was just too good to let go without a deeper discussion of it, and we couldn't think of anybody better than our first guest tonight. Noga Tarnopolsky is an internationally renowned journalist, award-winning journalist. Her writings have appeared in everything from the New York Times to the New Yorker. She's been based in 5 countries. She's now based out of Jerusalem, and we will be with her right after this break.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Or email us at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking about Hezbollah's leader going whoops. But what he did, folks. And joining us from Jerusalem is award-winning international journalist Noga Tarnopolsky. Noga, thanks very much for staying up this late. I hope.
Anytime.
I hope we interrupted something important.
I see.
Noga, did he go whoops? Did Nasrallah go whoops?
He is trying to do, not a whoops, but what we would call delicate maneuvering.
Who be we?
Who be we?
Who be we?
Political analysts would call what Nasrallah is trying to do right now is very delicate maneuvering. He wants to keep the terrified West thinking, that he won, the way it's been reported in, by and large, in the Israeli media. Certainly this kind of double reportage, in other words, you see a lot of the Francophone and Anglophone media reporting, not that they think he won, because they don't know, but that the Arabs in the street perceive that he won. So he's very eager to foment that. On the other hand, he has to appear extremely humble and regretful to his Lebanese host, if we could call him that, because he just...
You mean his Lebanese hostages?
Right. It's a very difficult term to... It's almost impossible. It's a situation of a kind of... a leech living off of a country. It's very difficult to describe in normal political terminology the relationship between Hezbollah and Lebanon.
That's a good terminology. I like the vision of Hassan Nasrallah as a leech sucking the blood out of the body politic of Lebanon. That's very good.
That's right. And Lebanon trying to regain its footing.
But no, I understand the balancing act. But the man said, if I knew what the Israeli response was going to be, I never would have done it. Now, if he's trying to show people in the West that he won and placate the people at home, that's not going to do it, because that shows that he's an idiot, number one. And number two,
if somebody says,
if I knew what the response was going to be, I wouldn't have done it, that's certainly not the words of somebody who considers themselves a victor.
No, these are not the words of someone spouting victorious, and that's really been... very interesting, although I have to say not unprecedented, because in the last few days he's been sending off trial balloons, and two or three of his underlings have come out and said, well, we didn't expect this reaction, we just thought we would exchange hostages. Look, one of the things that he's trying to do, in a very funny and weird and backhanded way, compliments Olmert, who's being battered back home, the Prime Minister of Israel. Because what he's saying is, look, this guy Olmert is a mad dog. I mean, all we did was step into his country, take two hostages. Not like we haven't done like four. Like,
yeah, it's for them. It's a normal negotiating tactic.
This guy went ballistic. Right.
Killed eight soldiers.
Took two.
And this is normal.
I started.
Or as we say in Quebec, c'est normal.
C'est normal. Exactement. C'est normal. And they were supposed to, you know, kidnap four back, and then we'd sit down and talk. Ha, 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 like we always do.
So a backhanded compliment back to Olmert, who's got his own problems in Israel.
Right. Funnily enough, there's a theory in Israel that, certainly there was a theory. Now things are so upset that it's hard to talk about theories in Israel, but there was a theory a few weeks ago that said, look, Olmert is a new and untested prime minister in a very, very, very delicate and volatile part of the world. He had no choice but to respond the way he did, not only for the rational reasons, because his sovereignty was violated, because he had three soldiers kidnapped in a period of, what, a week or two?
Yeah.
Not only because of the growing Iranian threat, but principally because of what Nasrallah just said. In other words, Olmert, the Israeli theory goes, had to show the Arabs that he's crazy and they better watch it.
But the question has been asked also, why didn't, and you just alluded to it, why didn't Olmert react that way to the 1,000 Qassam rocket attacks from Gaza? Why didn't he declare war against the Palestinian Authority when they kidnapped the young Israeli soldier before July 12th? Why this reaction to the north and not to the south?
There's several answers to that question. There are lots. First of all, Hezbollah, despite the fact that it's this amorphous, non-national entity leeching off of Lebanon, gives you a geographical place that you can actually bomb. So physically, it's possible to attack Hezbollah in a way that it is essentially physically impossible to attack Hamas that hides in the alleyways of this tiny, overpopulated strip.
Noga, I'll ask you to hold a thought for 1 second while we pay some bills and ask Montrealers to call in and see what you think about this remarkable statement by Hassan Nasrallah. Win, lose, or draw. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
And we're talking with Jerusalem-based international correspondent Noga Ternopolsky about the surprising developments in the Middle East, or particularly the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah's oops statement. He said, well, if he knew Israeli reaction would have been so fierce, he never would have done what he did. Noga, you were talking to us before the break about why Olmert's reaction to the Hezbollah kidnappings and not in the south to the Qassam rocket attacks and to the kidnappings by Hamas, and you were starting to make the point that the north offered an opportunity of a war zone, somewhere to attack.
Yeah, the north offers, if you want to send in infantry and you want to send in an air force, you can do so in Lebanon. You cannot do so in Gaza. Gaza is the size of a suburb, basically. The other thing is the question of a conspiracy. In other words, one soldier being kidnapped was seen as very, very grave, and Israel attempted immediately to engage in both less, I would say, dramatic, but nevertheless, you know, Israelis sent soldiers into Gaza immediately. Negotiations were pressed immediately. But the minute three soldiers have been kidnapped on two opposite borders, the affront to the nation and to its sovereignty is such that Olmert felt obliged to respond very, very differently. In those first few days, there was also a lot of talk about a possible connection, I'd say, that in fact the two kidnappings were being coordinated out of Damascus and that this was one part of a single campaign to drive Israelis crazy.
What does Nasrallah's statement tell us, if anything, about the strength of his Iranian / Syrian support on the one hand and the Lebanese, Egyptian, Jordanian, perhaps Saudi opposition on the other? What could it be telling us?
Well, let's start with something easier, if I may.
Sure.
What is he trying to say to Lebanon? What he's trying to say to Lebanon is, okay, I'm contrite. I didn't realize it would be this bad, A. But even more importantly, given the fact that Israel has been operating very publicly under the assumption that this ceasefire is not going to work, what Nasrallah is saying to his Lebanese compatriots is, I'm not going to do it again. When he says, had I known, what he's really saying is, it's not going
to
happen again.
And they're supposed to buy, that? Like Nasrallah's asked anybody's permission before?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question. In terms of the international axes you discussed before, it's also very interesting. It would appear that, Nasrallah, you know, one of the many speeches he gave during the war actually angrily accused, didn't go so far as to point out that Saudi Arabia and Egypt, for instance, two powerhouses, actively, vocally opposed him, but it did say that he thought he'd be getting more support from his Arab brethren. So he finds himself now having been supported economically and in terms of arms by Syria and by Iran, which was all well and good while he was being a war hero. But now he is the public face of what could be a PR disaster. And Iran and Syria are not standing up facing the Arab Brotherhood and saying, hey, hey, he's our guy. You have a problem with him, you come talk to us. They're willing to back him up, but they're not willing to stand up for him now.
A final thought and a very quick response, if you could. Is the perceived perhaps a break, not break, but certainly stretching of the fabric between Hezbollah and Iran, Syria, due to this speech. Was that any cause for Israel declaring who the leader of the Iranian front would be? That seemed like a strange...
I don't think there's a connection, sad to say. I don't think there's a connection. I don't think there's a breach between Hezbollah and Iran. I think, though, that what we're seeing very clearly is that Iran's the boss. Therefore, Iran sends him out to do ugly stuff when Iran needs him to, and then leaves him a little bit stranded when
they
international
don't.
Calls come in asking questions.
Noga Ternopolsky from Jerusalem, we thank you ever so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you.
And we wish you well and keep safe. Montreal will be back after the news.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Or email us at info@iapm.ca. We've just been speaking with Noga Tarnopolsky from Jerusalem, an award-winning international correspondent, about the what could be the latest storm brewing out there, political storm, military storm, with Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah kind of saying, oops, on the same day that Israel declared who would be in charge of their planning for a potential war on the Iranian front. But there's another storm brewing, a real storm, that has very real effects on people's lives. And Hurricane Ernesto is certainly nowhere near what Hurricane Katrina was, but it's coming at the same time. Tomorrow will be the first anniversary of Katrina. And I thought it would be important to look back 1 year in a very personal way. Because of our next guest, the Institute was very much involved in efforts to send supplies and men and materiel and expertise down to the affected states and the ravaged states. We ended up with the first agreement with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with any Canadian NGO that we can recall to help their Delta Relief Project. And much of our work at the Institute was in support of our next guest. Hal Newman has been a legend, and almost a legend in emergency response. He's not old enough to be a legend. So that was a compliment, Hal. I'm not aging you.
So it's okay, but I'm nowhere near legend.
A founder of the emergency response unit par excellence in Quebec, the one of the founders of Côte Saint-Luc EMS, the president of Team EMS, which are specialists in emergency response, and the man who galvanized what was arguably the most outstanding effort by Canadians in getting help down to the affected areas. It showed, as I wrote at the time, the power of one, the power of one person saying, let's do this, regardless of bureaucracies, regardless of anything. And Hal Newman, welcome. Thanks for sharing some time and thoughts with us tonight.
Hey, Beryl, thank you.
When you came to me with this idea last year, around a few days after Katrina hit, and I think, you know, your first thoughts was, let's get through the bureaucracies, both Canadian and American, to get some aid down there. But did you ever imagine that you would be boots on the ground, so to speak, in Mississippi and Louisiana? Because, folks, Hal was there. I mean, he saw the devastation. And you can read his reflections in the second issue of Barricades magazine, which is the journal of the Institute, www.barricades.ca, and go to the second issue, and you'll see Hal's reflections. Did you ever think you would be down there in the middle of all that?
No, not for a second. I it's interesting. I remember coming to you because, I was so involved with the ice storm with Côte Saint-Luc EMS, and I remember during the ice storm, seeing the crews coming in from the States and from God knows where to help us. And then when I came to see you last year to say, God, how are we going to get through all this crap? Because there was layers and layers and layers of crap.
It's good that you said crap, because Jim told me I couldn't say the other word.
Good. Well, in Vermont they say compost a cake. But there was just such layer. The United States was never geared up to accept aid. It just wasn't part of their plan, and it wasn't part of their psyche. And I remember coming to you and saying, come on, let's get people down there. How do we get down there, Beryl? And, of course, I had no functional clue. And, through my work with emergency...
Well, but you had the organizational network. You had the people that wanted to get down there across the country.
Right, but I just didn't know how to get, to navigate the layers. And then it's interesting because through my work with emergency management in the States, I had known about this compact called the Emergency Management Assistant Compact, which allows states to interchange for assistance. A big tornado comes through in Missouri, they can call over to Illinois and get help. So we said, you know, I remember saying to you, you know, maybe we can use that. Well, it turns out that no, you couldn't.
But we found some ways, and we're going to discuss those ways right after this break. Let's pay some bills. Hal Newman, please stay with us.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
Or email us at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking to Hal Newman, president of Team EMS, specialist in emergency responders, about his adventures, our adventures last year at the time of Hurricane Katrina. Hal Newman was singularly responsible for getting as many assets to the victims in Louisiana, Mississippi, as almost any other individual Canadian. Hal, you were telling us before the break how at the beginning you just wanted to break through bureaucracy to get your emergency response fellows and friends and the national network down there. And then it sort of ballooned.
Yeah, well, you know, with your help and with the Institute's help, and then Reverend Gray, there I was on the ground. I was working as part of the what was called the SNAKE team, which was a special needs assessment for the victims of Katrina. And it was a team put together by the National Organization on Disability in the States.
And you're one of the few Canadians, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's important for our listeners to know, you're one of the few Canadians, not just because you wanted to, but because you had the expertise to be called to come down there.
You know, no, there weren't very many, but, you know, I kind of see myself as a citizen of the world, and like you, the borders, it's a line on a map, and I can't tell you how many times the Americans have come to help us, especially like I talked about the ice storm, and you know, it was very emotional for me. I remember going down the 20, the closed 20, and you know, I borrowed a vehicle from Côte Saint-Luc to go home, and it was late at night, and I can't remember what night it was in the ice storm, and I was driving down the 20, which was pitch black, to go home to Pointe Claire, and along came this convoy, and it was, you know, I still get chills talking about it, and it was all these Con Ed Detroit trucks coming in under military escort. And I was, you know, and Beryl, you know, the border is just a line, and it used to be that you rang your bell and your neighbors came for help, and now we've just, such a word as bureaucratized?
Yep.
You know, we've just
to the point where we don't have confidence in ourselves anymore.
Yeah, we've just jammed the whole situation so that, you know, we can ring for help, and we need to fill out forms, and we need to check on liability, and we need to hear from someone who's, you know, detached in the Beltway in D.C. who's saying, no, they don't need help.
You remember the liability forms we had to make out for everybody who wanted to go down there?
Oh, yeah, sign your life away. you want to go and help, I mean, you know, sign your life away and your kids.
You were just talking about driving down the 20 in Montreal, but one of your most poignant memories that you shared with me soon after you got down there was, and that you share again, just for our listeners to know, that you share in your reflections on the trip, which you can find at www.barricades.ca, and look for Hal Newman's article in the second edition of the Institute's Journal. You were telling me about driving down a highway in a little town, and you saw a boat overturned. And you were struck,
right,
I think, by the name of the boat.
And I just wish that I had a camera at the time, but it wasn't a little boat, by the way, Beryl. I was miles inland. I was in a place near Bayou La Batre, Alabama.
That's
which is actually turns out where they actually filmed Forrest Gump, because it kind of looked like Bubba Gump should have been from there. And I was miles inland, and here was this shrimp boat. And, I mean, shrimp boats are huge. And it was sitting, you know, on the highway. And it was the Integrity was her name. And, she was intact sitting up there on the highway. Nothing much else intact, though.
What most touched you by the help that you brought to people? What were they most affected by? Yes, they needed food and clothing and all that, but you shared other reflections.
You know, people were just blown away that you were there and that you were there to lend a hand. And I remember going into the First Baptist Church in Jackson, Mississippi, which, by the way, was running a full intensive care unit in its gymnasium with nurses that they had somehow imported from a university in Georgia and supplies from God knows where, no government help. And they were just blown away that there was a Canuck in front of them. you know, willing to lend a hand. In many cases, really just to lend an ear. And then, you know, I'd get on the phone and I'd call you, or I'd call Reverend Gray, or I'd call Dr. Mitch, and I'd say, you know, I found a doctor who's lost everything, and all she has is her her medicine bag, and she's practicing medicine on her driveway in an old barbershop chair or a dentist chair. And then, you know, these emails would go out, and we'd get help to these folks. And all they really wanted to know was that someone was there. It's pretty basic, you know.
How did it feel after the bureaucracies got in the way sometimes, and the frustrations before, and then the feeling afterwards when you'd finally get through and you'd find that one person who was in this massive bureaucratic empire who was willing to help, and so often the person's near the very top?
Well, yeah, I'm sure you remember some of those conversations and some of the folks we met, but there was... I want to say Geraldine Johnson. I'm not positive that's her name.
Captain Geraldine Johnson, yeah.
There were people who were just willing to, you know, lay it out there and get us where we needed to go and get people on the ground, and were willing to, you know, look at the rules and then throw them out the window. And that was fantastic. And, you know, and then being able to team with, you know, the SCLC and, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the American Clergy Leadership Conference. Yeah, you know, as you know, I'm the secular guy.
Yeah.
Grew up Jewish, West End, white guy. And, you know, those were really cool moments. The cell phone would ring and it'd be, Brother Newman, are you there? And
well, Brother Newman, hold that thought. And I want to know what lessons you came away with that applied to your work now at the president of Team EMS. Montreal, we'll be back after this break.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
And we're talking with Team EMS President Hal Newman on the power of one, the power of a single individual to make a difference, as he did last year, getting his own boots on the ground in Louisiana, Mississippi, and helping the most displaced and affected people who are victims of Hurricane Katrina. Hal, what did you take back from those weeks that you use in your work today?
The single most important thing that I'd like to leave people with is that you need to create community. You need to mesh with your neighbors. If you're part of a faith-based organization, then you need to get your church, your synagogue, your mosque, you need to get out into your network, you need to do outreach, because when the crap hits the fan, folks, you only have each other. The government is going to be preoccupied with running government and with basic infrastructure. That was my takeaway. My takeaway was that the church, the faith-based organizations, that's where the strength was, and they continue to take care of people that have been neglected or left behind. That's my takeaway.
And your services, the services of Team EMS, are actually retained now by communities and organizations to tell them what they have to know and how they have to prepare.
Right. We would do a lot of basically network building and just teaching people how to quilt or stitch a network of contacts together. But, you know, what was the old, it takes a village, it takes a neighborhood.
Yeah, it takes a village to raise a child.
Right. It takes a neighborhood to save a life, really. And, you know, we talk about, like, having heart-safe communities with defibrillators. But if, you know, somehow a Category 4 storm gets loose on the St. Lawrence, and I'm only partially in jest there, but when the going gets tough, it's your community. It's your immediate neighborhood. And you need to reach out, and you need to form those networks, and you need to take care of one another.
Is there sometimes a feeling of frustration? I know I have it, and... that when you see a disaster, when you see a time of crisis, people pull together, even the hardest-hearted bureaucrats somehow melt and become responsive. And then somehow after the crisis is finished, you know, people come back to worrying about the silliest little things, and they forget that transcendental state almost that everybody was in. It's got to be disheartening a bit, particularly when you're in emergency response work and you see the real crises of life. You know, and it's not about $7 or $9 a day daycare. It's about life and death. It's about people pulling together and having the capacity of soul and spirit to pull together.
Yeah, it kills me when we go back to basically a soulless society, and we crank back into the bureaucracy. You know, there's an old adage that the further we are from the last emergency, the closest we are to the next one. And look at what's going on with Ernesto. I mean, Katrina, you know, the diaspora of Katrina is still being tracked, and here come the next storms.
How many displaced? 350,000 still haven't come back?
In Mississippi, there were 600,000 just in the state of Mississippi. The figures are very interesting. You know, I saw an Oxfam plea today for the state of Mississippi to help stranded families. We're a year later, and we still have special needs families. So that's people medically fragile, special needs kids, people with disabilities who still don't have a place to live.
Remarkable. But you know what? You showed what the power of one can be.
No, Beryl, we showed. I'm very uncomfortable with the concept that it's all about me. It wasn't. I went to you for help. You reached out to your network. I reached out to mine. It just happens that my name's on the plaque.
You inspired.
Reverend Gray. I mean, look at all the people, Beryl. It's not just one person. It never really is just one person.
You inspired a lot of people. And I just want to remind everybody, every time any of you listeners get down, every time you get depressed about being put upon and forgotten, just remember what Bobby Kennedy said in Soweto in 1966, that each time a man stands up for an ideal and acts to improve the lot of others, he creates a center of energy and daring whose ripples can build a current from 1,000 other centers that will sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. And that's what it's all about. Al Newman, we thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Be well, Beryl. Be well, Mo.
Chris Smith, Master Control, thanks very much. In Montreal, remember the lessons and remember them well. Keep them close to your heart. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.
Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, can be heard Monday through Thursday night from 7 to 8.